All right. Now, the Torah class. So, first of all, for those of you who have not been here, we are now in the second book of Samuel, which tells the story, the continuing story of King David. One of two books is okay. If you took an Eitz Chaim Chumash from the, it won't help you at all. So, just forget that. You can either get Robert Alter's The David Story or any complete version of the Bible, okay, which has the book of Samuel in it. The one that I recommend, just because it's the most readable, the gift shop has it, what a lot of you are holding it, is the JPS Tanakh, T-A-N-A-K-H, or Robert Alter's The Story of David. Either one of those books will help you, otherwise not. You're welcome to have the Hebrew if you want. We refer to the Hebrew occasionally. I actually didn't even bring it today because I didn't even know if we'd get to the text because I want to bring everybody up to date. But we work with the English. I want to review the story up to now before we continue, just so everybody has it. I mean, whether you were here or not here, but so you have it fresh in your mind. And then we'll move on. Once again, the book of Samuel, it used to be one large book, but scrolls are very unwieldy, so they divided it into two, and it's called Samuel 1 and 2. And the book, even though it's called Samuel, most of it is the story of David. It's just called Samuel because he's the main character at the beginning of the book, okay? Samuel is the high priest. We don't have to go into his story. It's a separate one, really. He ends up anointing Saul as king. Saul becomes the first king of Israel. Saul is one of three people in the story of Samuel who are called tall or imposing looking, and all three of them are failures. There's Saul, there's David's older brother Eliab, who's passed over for the kingship in favor of David, and the third is Goliath. So already, if the story says you're tall and imposing, you know that it's not going to be good. And this parallels, by the way, Israel, right? Israel is small and weak, but God loves Israel and doesn't love the big nations around it that are tall and that are the equivalent of tall and imposing. So Saul is appointed king. He briefly has a good run, but without going into too much detail, Saul is the feature of Saul's character that runs throughout the story is that he is fearful. And it's not good if you're the king of Israel to be fearful. When they first find him, he's hiding among whatever the luggage is. That's when Samuel first finds him. Remember, for whatever reason, when Goliath comes, Saul doesn't fight him. Maybe because he's king, but he doesn't even say, "I wish I could, but I'm king." Instead, he's looking for someone else to fight him. He doesn't kill Agag, who's the king eventually the line of Amalek, because he's fearful, it seems, of the people. He's fearful of his own troops, and he's paranoid about David. Really frightened of David. Not at first. David comes to Saul. David actually is introduced to Saul a couple of times. He's introduced to him at Goliath, the story of, but before that, before, even though Saul doesn't seem to know who he is, David comes to Saul when Saul's attendants say, "We need to find somebody to play music to coax Saul out of his melancholy," because he seems manic depressive or bipolar. He has some kind of mental disorder. He has these states where he's ecstatic and he has states where he's deeply, deeply depressed. So David comes to Saul and plays music for him, and the first time, the first person of several in the book who are said to love David is Saul. It says that Saul loved David. Later on, by the way, Saul's daughter will love David, Michal, at least for a while, and Saul's son Jonathan will love David. But Saul is the first one. And this begins a sort of gestalt, you know those gestalt experiments where you look at the cup and you see one thing and then you look at it different, you blink your eyes and you see two faces. David's like that, in that do they all love David because he's wonderful? Or is David this Machiavellian manipulator who knows that if he gets the king to love him and the king's daughter to love him and the heir apparent who's the king's son to love him, that he can replace the king, have his replacement be legitimate because he'll be married to the king's daughter, and eliminate, not by murder, but by affection, the king's heir, who's the son. I mean, it works very well for David that all these people fall for him. Does that mean that it was deliberate, or did they just, that's who David is, or some combination thereof, because people's motives are rarely unmixed? And this happens again and again and again. As we will see in the course of the year, or however long it takes us to get through the second half of Samuel, and we've already seen, David has this remarkable tendency to have his enemies eliminated by other people. And he's always guiltless. So, for example, someone kills Saul in battle, or actually claims to, although it doesn't seem like they really kill Saul. So it looks like Saul commits suicide. And then comes to David, and David gets upset that the person would kill Saul and has him put to death. Now, if David had anything to do with it, realize what he's just done. He's eliminated his rival and the only person who knows that he eliminated his rival, all in one stroke. So it's very hard to know what it is that David's up to, but it's very easy to see David's gradual progress to the kingship, and also to realize that you probably couldn't be king in the ancient world in any kind of tribe without some element of cunning and ruthlessness. It's a very, I mean, it's true for politicians today, and it was a, seriously, but it was a much tougher world then, a much tougher world then. Look, I think I've told the story here before. If I haven't, I will now, although I probably shouldn't. A past president of Sinai, which is not as tough as ancient Israel. Almost. When I interviewed Lo those many years ago for the job, one of the past presidents of Sinai came up to me and said, "Really, there's only one question that I need to ask you that that you haven't been asked that's really important to know." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Are you good at politics?" I don't really know. I suppose I could be. He said, "Because you'll need to be." So any organization has politics, and that is certain. I mean, in ancient Israel, the competition for rulership, was fierce. I think it was Louis XIV who said, "I would rather be killed by my enemies than by my children," because a lot of kings were killed by their own kids because they were going to be the heirs. And so it was not. I mean, so you couldn't imagine that David actually could have been king of Israel if he was a naive. If he was just like a pious believer in God and let God take care of everything, he would have been dead in a minute. And so to say that David was cunning is not necessarily to insult David. It's to say he had the skills that were necessary to lead a small people in the ancient world successfully, which he did. How cunning, that's always a question around the margins. Now, we have not yet gotten to feel free, by the way, if the sun moves and you're uncomfortable or you can't see, move around, that's not a problem. We have not yet gotten, of course, to the thing that David does that is considered the worst thing, which is the story of Bathsheba, although we will. The first half of the story, the part that we have read up to now, is almost entirely the story of Saul's downfall and David's rise. And one of the things that happens there that's worth remembering that will have an influence later is, so David moves into Saul's house. Saul becomes jealous because David's a warrior. He kills Goliath. The women start singing in the streets. Saul's killed thousands. David has killed tens of thousands. And you can imagine how Saul feels about that. While he's still king. So he starts to seek David's life, basically. He throws his spear at him twice in his own room, which David, I mean, like in the whatever room of the, we say palace, but it's not a palace, or wherever Saul lives. David eludes that. He runs away. He comes back. Saul apologizes. Then finally, David realizes there's just no way that he's going to survive being close to Saul. He runs away again. Twice, when Saul is following him, David surprises Saul. Once, when Saul is probably either, depending on which interpreter you believe, relieving himself either urinating or defecating, but one of the two. David cuts off a piece of his robe without his knowing, and then later says, look, I could have killed you. And then Saul weeps and apologizes, but this happens a couple of times. I think that Saul is insincere. He's just not stable. He's not a stable character. David finally realizes there is no way that he can stay in Israel's territory and stay alive. One way or another, I mean, Saul's still king. He's going to get him. Even though David has a band of like a ragtag band of outlaws around him, sooner or later, Saul's going to kill him. So he runs away to the Philistines. Now, the Philistines are the Israelites, basically their arch enemy, basically. But they know the Israelites as the Israelites know them. In some ways, it's not so different from today, the Israel and the Israelis and the Palestinians. American Jews don't know the Palestinians. Israeli Jews over the years have had many, many, many different kinds of contacts. I mean, they may not like each other, but they know each other very well. A lot of Palestinians speak Hebrew. You know, they know each other because they're in proximity. They live right next to each other. So the same thing in ancient Israel, the Philistines and the Israelites, they knew each other. It wasn't that they lived and there was this border and they had no idea what was happening over the border. It wasn't the kind of distances like us and Mexico. I mean, it was more the kind of distances like us in Beverly Hills. Right? I mean, you go to Israel and you realize the country's like as big as this table. You can see the Jordan is right there. So David runs away to the Philistines and they all know who he is. And they know that he needs their protection. So the king of the Philistines sort of takes David in as a vassal. That means he's his servant, basically. And David raids these villages and claims to the king that he's raiding Israelite villages so that the king will think that he's loyal to the Philistines and not to the Israelites. But David's not raiding Israelite villages. He's actually raiding villages of non-Philistines that live in Philistine territory. So he'll go and he'll raid this village of Amalekites or whatever, and he'll take all their riches and he'll bring some of them to the king and some of them he'll keep for himself. But because he can't let the king know that he's not raiding Israelite villages, because if he does, he will be killed, right? Because if the king knows he's still loyal to the Israelites, what does David do in the villages? He kills everyone, men, women, children. He kills everyone. Look, I'm not making this up. It's right there, right? So again, so you ask yourself, it's in some ways, it's like when Abraham passes off his wife as his sister. You know that the only alternative for David is to be killed. It's not like he has a third choice. He kills the people in the village, or he dies, either at the hand of Saul or the hand of the king of the Philistines. So what do you do? And you can imagine that the commentators have a really hard time with this. But you also know that there's no other way for David to survive. There's no third choice. Anyway, David does this for a while. And you realize also that this is going to make David suspicious when he goes back to Israel. Because how do you spend a year or two surviving in enemy territory and then come back and have everybody say, oh, I'm sure you never helped the Philistines at all. So David's story is really complicated, much more complicated than we imagine before we actually read it, you know, because David Melech Yisrael, Chai Vekayam. And so you don't have to think about that. That's not the way it goes in the book. He's in Philistine territory. He's trying to survive, and he doesn't want to help the Philistines if he doesn't have to. So then what happens in the end is in the battle that Saul dies at, and I'm going to come to that in a second, the king of the Philistines says to David, I want you to come into battle with us against the Israelites. And now it's like almost like a cliffhanger. You can't imagine how is David going to get out of this, because either he's going to fight against the Israelites, which it doesn't seem like he either could or would. And in fact, there are lots of reasons to think that he wouldn't. There was a really, when I was writing the book, because I wrote, as most of you know, I wrote a book about David, which is why one of the reasons why the story is so fresh in my mind. I just sent the manuscript out actually about a couple of weeks ago. But I read a wonderful article by an Israeli scholar named Yael Shemesh, And so the question is, you know, as modern biblical critics say, would David have fought with the Philistines if he'd had to? Because the way he gets out of it, let me just tell you, is the Philistine commanders say, we don't want this guy. He's an Israelite. We don't trust him. Maybe you, king, trust him, but we don't trust him. So the king says to David, I'm sorry, my commanders don't trust you, so you can't fight with me. And David gets out of it. But what if they had said, yeah, we want him to fight? What would he have done? So Yael Shemesh argues, I think pretty convincingly, that David, one way or another, would have gotten out of it, not only because he uses that kind of language. That is, when the king says, you will come fight with us, he says, your majesty, of course, knows what I will do. Mm-hmm. He never says, I'll fight with you, or anything. I mean, he uses very ambiguous language. But also, she points out that when it says that David has slain tens of thousands, and even Jonathan says to Saul in argument, he says, you know how loyal a soldier David has always been to you. Why are you after him? I mean, there's like everything to indicate that David was a loyal Israelite soldier, and one way or another maybe would have run away. We don't know. But in any case, he doesn't have to, because the Philistine commanders don't trust him. And although the people, you know, there's a whole school of David is a bad guy scholars. There's one book in particular by a guy named Stephen McKenzie. It's a very good book, but it's a good book because he makes the best case you can possibly make that David is a thoroughgoing scoundrel. You know, and it's like, if you want to argue that David is good, you have to argue against McKenzie. So he says, yeah, I grant you that David doesn't fight with the Philistines, but you don't think that he gave them any intelligence information about Israelite troops and Israelite movements and Israelite battles? He said, he must have. Why would they not ask him? Even if, you know, and they win the battle convincingly and they kill Saul, and then when David comes later, Saul's house never likes David. And so there's a lot that we can't know. Although I think, I mean, I don't talk about this in the book, but my counterargument would be, why would they believe David's intelligence information? He could just as easily lie to them, you know? I mean, that's, but anyway, so Saul, on the other hand, once again, fearful before the battle, Saul, in a very bizarre scene, not like any other scene in the Tanakh, Saul, having forbidden fortune tellers in Israel, goes to this Baalat Ov, which literally, by the way, translates as ghost wife. Right? That's what it really translates as. But it's some kind of fortune teller who brings Samuel up from the dead, which Samuel is unhappy about, by the way. And at Saul's request, she brings Samuel up from the dead. Samuel comes up from the dead and says, you know, why are you bothering me? And Saul says, because God won't answer me. Because Saul at this point is asking God questions and God won't answer anymore. In startling contrast to David, who, no matter what he does, God always answers him. David betrays God, but he's never abandoned by God, ever. God gets angry at David, but he never goes away. And one thing that I didn't realize, as many times as I read this story, and I don't even remember which of the books I read it in, but someone points out that in the entire story of David, there's not a single miracle. Not one. Not a single supernatural. I mean, God speaks to David. If you want to call that a miracle, that's a miracle. Or Samuel calls up from the dead. If you want to call that a miracle, if it's real, but there's not a miracle like there is in the Torah. It's all, and that's one of the reasons why when you read it, it feels so believable. Seas don't split, and the sun doesn't stop. It's not like Joshua. It's not like Exodus. It's a very human story. David never even asks for a miracle. I mean, God says, you know, do you want me to punish you or the people or this or that? Do you want to lose a war? Or do you want a plague? So David opts for a plague because he says, I'd rather have God's mercy than human mercy. And a plague breaks out. But that's not a miracle. A plague is a natural happening, right? It happened all the time in the ancient world. It does in the modern world, too. Which reminds me, by the way, I just read this article that Purell is bad for you. I was like, it turned my whole world upside down. I live on Purell. So speaking of plagues, that it kills like bacteria that you need and it leaves undisturbed all the bacteria that you don't need and you shouldn't use it. And it's, anyway, look it up. It's worth checking out. I don't know. Yes, it says, basically the article, at the end of the article, it said, wash your hands. But I said that because the Torah class is about all sorts of useful information. So it was on CNN blogs. So the one exception to that in some ways is obviously that Samuel comes up from the dead. And he says to Saul, you're going to die tomorrow. You're going to die in battle. It's all over for you. And Saul, of course, is tremendously despairing. And then there's a big argument, by the way, among the classical commentators. And I'm not talking about like people today. I mean going way back to the 9th, 10th century, about whether this was real or the ghost wife was playing a sophisticated trick, as mediums have throughout history. And she just guessed that, you know, Saul was so despairing and Israel was overwhelmed and everyone knew they were going to lose the battle and he just looked like a man who was. So who knows? Anyway, whichever you want to believe, both whichever you want to believe and whichever you think the story wants you to believe. He does die the next day, both Jonathan and Samuel. And Saul both die in the battle. And this now leaves David as, I won't say the undisputed king, but as the apparent king of a very divided country. In all through the book of Samuel, there's a division between the north and the south. In fact, it's only united as one country under Saul, David, and Solomon. That's it. Then it breaks apart, never to be united again. The north is Israel, the south is Judah. They stay separate forever, really. Even now you can't say they're united the way they were because the north was the 10 tribes. And when it was conquered by the Assyrians, they all got lost. That's why we don't know who's a Benjaminite and who's a Danite and who, you know, they're all gone. The south remained until it was conquered and the temple was destroyed about 150 years later. But however that happened, when David takes over the kingship, his base is in the south and Saul's is in the north. As we will see, as we continue, Saul has heirs, maybe not Jonathan, but he has other heirs that are going to contest the kingship and David until David systematically, in one way or another, succeeds in overcoming them. So even though it's true that Saul is gone, it's not true that therefore the entire country acclaims David as the king of Israel. And that more or less brings us up to date. Now let me ask if there are any questions or comments about any of the story up to now. Yeah.
Why was Saul anointed king?
You have to ask God. The question was, why was Saul anointed king? And I said, only somewhat flippantly, you have to ask God. One of the things that you find throughout the Torah is that God does things that don't work, right? I mean, God made the world before Noah. It didn't work. So you say, what's that about? How does God, like, blow it? And I don't know that there's an answer to that. I suppose a commentator would say Saul had his chance. Saul deserved a chance. God realized that he had the potential, but he did not capitalize on it. But who knows? Or maybe Saul was necessary to make the way for David. But I don't know. Yeah. I think that the idea, why is it mentioned that Saul's relieving himself? So there are a lot of things that Saul does, like prophesy naked, relieving himself, that are humiliating. And I think that the idea is the book of David was, with the story was, almost everyone agrees. I say almost everyone, I mean like 95% of biblical scholars will tell you, maybe more, that the book of Samuel was written by somebody to legitimate David's kingship. One of the ways that you legitimate David's kingship is by making illegitimate the house that preceded him. You say, just like in the ancient world, when you know one kingship took over, they would wipe out all the annals about the previous king. So if you make Saul look worse, it makes David look better. Like, obviously David had to take over from this guy who, you know, is in the cave relieving himself and doesn't even know that David crept up behind him and cut his coat off. That would be my guess. But Saul looks, you know, Saul is, in some ways, he's the most, you hate to use this word about a king, but he's the most pathetic character in the Bible in some ways. So that's worse. It's worse as a king, worse than being defeated is being seen as pathetic. You know, and that's how Saul looks when he goes to the ghost wife, and when he's in the cave, and when he cries and apologizes to David and then seeks his life. So, anyway. Yeah?
In terms of popular knowledge at that time, did a lot of people know that David had been anointed by Samuel?
It's a good question. Not at first, clearly, although his brothers do, but it does not seem like Saul knows or anybody else knows, like it was secret, and the sequence doesn't work anyway. That is, doesn't make sense that he gets anointed before the David and Goliath thing, because he gets anointed in front of his brothers, and then his brother says, "What are you doing here, in front of Goliath? Like, you know, get out of my face, little brother," basically. So, no, I don't think so. And it's not clear that people ever know that he was anointed by Samuel, although he takes over as king. Yeah. Well, that's what he asked, why Saul? And I said, look, I can't answer that question. I mean, I can only give the same answer that I gave before. Maybe to make the way for David, maybe because Saul had the possibility, maybe. And also, there was also the question, as you point out, of why the people needed a king anyway. I mean, remember that Saul is the first king. Why didn't they have a king before that? Because Israel is anti-monarchy. It's supposed to be a theocracy. It's supposed to be ruled by God. But ruled by God effectively means ruled by the priests. That's what it really means. And I think ruled by the priests was not what people wanted. They wanted military leader, political leader, and it's better, healthier for a country if there's some separation and even struggle between the religious and the political wing. It's not good if all the power is concentrated in one or the other. So, for whatever reason, the way that it works is that the king is not, I mean, in some places the king is God, right? In Pharaoh was a god. In Israel, the king is never God. That's a good thing. But the king is chosen by God. So the king is not just, you know, he's not just by popular acclaim. So it's true, it poses a problem when you have an unsuccessful king. Why would God have chosen? Look, Saul's not the only unsuccessful king in Israel. There are a lot of unsuccessful kings. If you go into the book of Kings, some of them are better than others. And not only that, but some of them are wicked, which Saul wasn't in the way that that Omri was, for example. Omri's an interesting example, probably not a household name, but he's in the book of Kings. He rules for almost 40 years. He's a very successful king, but he's not a pious king. So the Bible sort of dispatches him in just a couple of verses, despite the fact that he clearly, politically, was very successful. So it's a tough thing to say. Why does God pick people? You know, okay, 1-2. Yeah.
Are there any other people in power, like Saul, who the Bible treats as so obviously mentally ill?
No, not that I can think of. I mean, I have to think about it carefully, but I can't think of anyone else except maybe the late Woodrow Wilson after his stroke. That's the only person. No, no, actually, he's not in the Bible. But all these people in the past, they meld together. I can't even think of anyone else. I'm not even sure that I can think of anyone else who is portrayed as mentally ill, unless you consider some of the prophets, not as prophets, but as prophets who walk around for years naked or who chain themselves to things or so on. Today, we would call them mentally ill. Then, it was not only was it not mental illness, but it was considered a mark of God's special providence that you would do these strange things that would, and this is just, you know, my brother teaches my brother's a sociologist at Emory. He taught a course for years, and actually it's in the teaching company, you can get his lectures, on deviance. And what's deviant in one society is normal in another. So deviance is, part of the course is that deviance is socially constructed. When we say this is crazy, that if you took that same thing and you put it in a tribe, they might say that's a mark of God. That's not crazy at all. That makes you holy. So it's hard to say, but Saul is the one character who's treated by the Torah as crazy in some ways. He's clearly not stable even by the text's own standard. It's not that they think of this as a mark of holiness. Not at all. Yeah.
Got a question. That being, why was it given credibility that he said you are going to die tomorrow when you hear people say the world is going to end on May 23rd?
Well, because why was it given credibility then or now? Because Saul specifically sought out somebody who he believed would tell the truth, would know the truth, right? He seeks this woman out. Presumably she has some kind of skill or record or whatever, so he believes her. Otherwise, he wouldn't have gone to her in the first place if he didn't believe that she would know the future, right? I don't know why he believes that this woman does, but he obviously believes it. She must have had some kind of reputation in the ancient world. Yeah.
Samuel seems to play a variety of roles, religious, political.
Yep.
And then Eve dies. Does all of that religious, political power then shift to Saul as in the kingship and then to David?
No, there's a line of priests after him. Right. The priests stay in the temple, and so there's religious and political power never quite meld in Israel. There's always, until the temple is destroyed, and then to some extent, it's taken over by the rabbis, but there isn't a real political leadership. The rabbis are, to the extent that there's a political leadership, I suppose the rabbis are that too. There's always separate, and the struggles between the priests and the king never end. They never end, which makes sense because, even today, even in America, where there's a clear separation, there's still political versus religious, struggles. And in countries where there isn't as much of a separation, there's much more struggle. Look at Israel as a good example. Forget places where clerical power and political power are the same, like in Iran, where the supreme leader is also a supreme religious leader. But in Israel, where there's only a limited area in which you can have political power, there are religious parties who claim religion as the political trump card. So
maybe that's part of the why Saul, even if you're shifting political power to someone who's unstable, it's still a positive development in the long run to move it away.
Yes, that could be. You could make that argument that God chose Saul because he was the most plausible candidate at the time, and it was really important to get a non-priest. Although, in the Torah, it seems like God doesn't want the people to have a king. The people do, but God doesn't seem to want it. So, because in a way, it's a repudiation of God. God's not enough. We need a political leader. And that's why David, that's one of the reasons, there are many why David is so powerful, is that David, one of the things that David does right, clearly right, is David is a religious figure. Almost alone among kings, there's no hint of idolatry anywhere in David's story. He never worships idols. He never traffics in idols, which is very rare among kings in ancient Israel. Not only that, but don't forget that the Psalms are attributed to David. So David is a worshipful figure. When David does something wrong, Unlike other figures in the Bible, he immediately turns to God. He begs God's forgiveness. I mean, David's clearly got, in one way or another, a religious personality, so that he combines both religious and political power. And that's one of the many, many reasons, I think, why he was thought of as the person who would eventually give birth to the Messiah. Because the Messiah unites both religious and political power. Remember, the Messiah is supposed to be a king eventually. So
tomorrow.
Yeah, that's the Gershon Scholem put it that way. The scholar of mysticism said that for most of the Middle Ages, Jews lived life in deferment, which means like they postponed life because they kept expecting the Messiah to come. Yeah.
Probably a silly question, but in your research, was David born just naturally savvy and politically smart, or so little?
So there's nothing it actually is an interesting point that there's nothing about David's childhood whatsoever, and his mother isn't even named or mentioned. Yeah. Not at all. She is in the Midrash. I mean, the rabbis invent an identity for her, but she's not mentioned at all in the Torah. We know nothing about her, except, although, I mean, this just occurred to me, I haven't really thought about it before, except that if Freud's right, people of exceptional self-confidence are generally people who are favored by their mothers. So you might think that maybe David, as the youngest, which he was his mother's darling, and maybe that's part of the reason why he had, I mean, look, to challenge Goliath, you know? I reviewed, Malcolm Gladwell has a new book called David and Goliath that I reviewed for Tablet Magazine. The truth, Malcolm Gladwell's the guy who wrote Blink and what was his other famous book? I don't remember. Anyway, it's not a very good book. It tells great stories, but it's not really a very good book. The stories somehow don't fit together. But all the stories individually are a lot of fun. And he begins by David and Goliath, and his point about the David and Goliath story, which is absolutely true, and every biblical scholar will confirm this, is that the idea that David was an underdog is completely wrong. Think about this for a second. What does Goliath have as a weapon? He's got a sword. What does David have? He has a long-distance weapon. A slingshot's a much better weapon than a sword. And not only that, but he conceals it. He doesn't tell anybody, I'm going to have a slingshot. Goliath has no idea that he's about to get hit by a long-distance weapon. And if you do the research, people who are expert with slingshots are really expert. They really can hit something very far away with great accuracy, and, of course, leave it to modern Israeli physics, they've even measured the velocity of the stone that is shot by slingshots, and it easily could kill somebody, or at the very least knock them out. They know how fast the stones go. So you think that David, but this is very typical of David. You think that David is the underdog, but in fact, David goes into that battle knowing he's going to win. And it's just that nobody else has the savvy to think, just because Goliath comes with a sword doesn't mean I have to come with a sword. But that's very typical of David. He really, one of the things that when I talked about David in the book, I said that he was one of those people who enlarges the possibilities. He sees alternatives where you or I wouldn't normally see alternatives, like a slingshot against Goliath. I mean, all of Israel is there. Why does no one else think of that? And this kid does. So David is, I mean, in that sense, he's sort of original and creative. And he's not really an underdog at all. He just makes it appear that he is. Remember that Saul gives him his armor in the story. Saul says, here, put on my armor, and David puts it on, he can't even walk. He says, I don't want this. And so he takes off Saul's armor, which also is very symbolic. Yeah, yeah. It's like, I'm not going to wear your kingship armor. And then when he cuts off Saul's cloak, again, it's a way of saying, you know, this may have been sufficient for you, but not for me. And by the way, when he cuts off Goliath's head, because the stone doesn't kill Goliath, there's a good trivia question for you. What happens is the stone knocks him out, and David comes and cuts Goliath's head off with Goliath's own sword. Wow. Own sword, and then takes it away. Wow. It's his. he takes it away.
But he was tiny.
It's probably not that hard to cut off a head if you've got a big sword. And yeah. Yeah. It doesn't say he was tiny, right? He may have been small, but it doesn't say he was tiny, and he could have been strong. But anyway, he cuts off his head, and then he takes the sword with him. So if anybody, you know, you can imagine it on the mantelpiece. Ooh, what's that? Well, let me tell you the story of when I killed Goliath.
It's a great painting by Caravaggio.
Right, exactly so. Yep, there are among the scenes in David's life, the most painted one, I think, although there are a lot of David and Bathsheba ones, the most painted one is the David and Goliath. There are some fantastic representations. Yeah. Right, it's exactly like the Indiana Jones when I thought of that, where he takes out a gun and the guy's got a whip.
Yeah.
And it's like he's, yes.
Yeah.
Takes out. By the way, do any of you watch The Big Bang Theory?
Yes.
Yes.
Did you see the thing about Indiana Jones? It was on this past week. Where it was so funny. Where Mayim Bialik, who plays the girlfriend to Sheldon, the main character. So Sheldon loves Indiana Jones and they watch it together. And she says... he says, isn't that amazing? Isn't that wonderful? I've seen it like 36 times. She goes, that, of course, the plot has a big hole. He goes, there's no hole in that. There's no problem with that. She goes, yes, there is. She says, Indiana Jones doesn't change anything at all. If he wasn't in the movie, the result would be exactly the same. He says, what are you talking about? She goes, well, the Nazis still would dig it up. They would open the ark. It would kill them all. And then it would be put away. It doesn't matter. And his jaw drops. He completely realizes that she's exactly right, that his presence is superfluous to the movie. It was very funny. Sorry if I just ruined Indiana Jones for you. All right. So any other questions? Yes, please. It's never so simple as the goal justifies. The answer to whether the ends are justified by the means is sometimes yes and sometimes no. Sometimes in Judaism, how can you live a life where the ends never justify the means? Sometimes it has to, right? I mean, is there war? If there's war, then sometimes the ends justify the means. And there's war in Judaism. Yes. There you go. Yep, that's right. That's a very hard case of whether the ends justify the means or not. Yes. So it's never, those kinds of blanket generalizations about religions always have billions of exceptions. Always. Yeah.
I've been struggling with David killing all these people. He had a precedent for it. Joshua was given the same.
Right.
Joshua did the same thing.
You can't.
Kill everything.
Yep. Well, you would be a lousy general in the ancient world. That's all I can say.
I'd be a dead private.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Dead private.
A dead private. You know what? The only thing I would say is, you say you would be a dead private, but that's sitting here. Put you in the war with people trying to kill you? I don't know. And by the way, they didn't always kill everything. Sometimes they took the women. If that makes you feel any better. I know. It's right. It's a very problematic thing. There's no question about it. And war in the ancient world is, I mean, war in general, but war in the ancient world was brutal. It was just brutal. Yeah. Right, he gets it back later from the priest of Nob. We don't know. Doesn't say. I always think of it like Babe Ruth's bat, you know? This huge, but it doesn't say what... but later, that's right, we don't even know how the priest of Nob got it. How did all of a sudden show up in a priest's house? You know? I don't know. Last question.
I mean, in David's story, everything else looks more real, but Goliath, is that the only mythical...
It's the most story-ish, the most fairy tale-ish part of the story is Goliath.
That's
true.
Explain that?
I don't know. It sounds like a folk tale. In fact, in the Book of Chronicles, the death of Goliath is attributed to someone else, not to David. So It's the most fairy tale-ish part. I don't know why that, you know, unless it's to give David, like Washington chopping down the cherry tree, some story of his beginnings that's, you know, other than he just rose to kingship.
Yeah,
but I don't know.
Doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't fit with, it's true, it does not fit with everything else. Okay, please rise.